Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show with me, Robert Bound. Last year, the film director Luca Guadagnino charmed audiences with the beautiful first love romance Call Me By Your Name. This year, he gives us Suspiria. It's a little different. A super gory, cold-blooded yet camp remake of Dario Argento's 1977 horror classic of the same name. Of lingering glances, there are few. You'll be peeping through your fingers. Of warm summer nights, well, we're in a wet and cold and divided Berlin. Blood-curdling screams. Though, take your pick. Guadagnino has been trying to make Suspiria for over a decade, so has he done the original justice? What sort of a thing is it? And can we enjoy ever again a night of cutting-edge avant-garde contemporary dance? Could we ever? Join me in the studio today to discuss the film are the critics Simran Hans and Jason Solomon. So it's West Berlin in 1977, and an ambitious young dancer from America, played by Dakota Johnson, turns up to audition for the avant-garde Helena Marcos Dance School, headed by the austere, elegant Madame Blanc. That's Tilda Swinton. A pupil, Patrizia, has disappeared. But why? What's going on in this dark castle of mirrors, marble, and beautiful outfits? At the same time, Dr. Joseph Klemperer, an elderly psychiatrist, grieves his wife, lost to the concentration camps of the Third Reich. His story and the secrets of the dance school become one, sort of.
You have to decide, what is it you want to be for this company?
There's more in that building than what you can see, Doctor.
You are living with dangerous people.
Oh, well, Jason Simran, welcome to the programme.
Hi, Rob.
Hello.
That got us in the mood, didn't it? The sort of sound of gore. How did Suspiria leave you feeling, Simran?
Well, I haven't actually seen the original film, so I kind of debated and toyed with maybe watching it first, and then I thought, maybe not. Maybe I'll just go in and see it for what it is. And I'm not particularly a sort of super fan of Luca Guadagnino. I really like A Bigger Splash. I'm kind of mild on Call Me By Your Name. I think I Am Love is all right. So, you know, I was maybe a skeptic going in. And actually, I think there are a lot of ways in which this film doesn't quite work, but I was kind of into it.
Jason, it's quite an you also notice from that what an uneven body of work Luca Guadagnino has done. I mean, uneven in a good way, possibly.
Well, they were called the Desire Trilogy, which Simran sort of enumerated for us there, which I think is very loose. I mean, I think he kind of said, I've made two, and can I have some money for more? Oh, it's a trilogy, therefore I get Call Me By
a trilogy after the fact.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't see that. I see Suspiria very much, you know, part of that Desire Trilogy, because there is a sort of absolute cupidity involved in it. People wanting stuff all over the place. You know, Dakota Johnson's character wants to be part of this corps de ballet, and Tilda Swinton wants to get her masterpiece out there, this masterwork dance that she's got there for everybody. And so there's a lot of that going on, and I think it's a film very much about desire, and it's Luca Guadagnino's desire as well to honour the memory of Argento, almost to trash the memory of Argento a bit. I think it is an homage to it, but I think it's a completely different movie. Everyone's sort of saying, oh, it's a remake of it. It isn't at all. It's sort of based on a similar idea. It's very, very different to it. And I think it's better. I'm not a horror fan. So I think this art house, scary, spooky, bone-cracking, mirror-refracting art house ballet dance I thought was brilliant and out there. As so I kind of loved it, like a long Italian lunch, but full of far too many rich flavours and different dishes and five courses. You know, when they're like, you're a pastor, you think that's lovely, I'm finished. They say, no, you've got three more courses to come. That's what this is like.
Yes, exactly. It's kind of never ending, but it held me. It's had kind of quite mixed reviews, and people sort of saying there's a lot of dips in the kind of plot and things, or in the pacing of it. I kind of stuck with it, Simran. It sounds like you did too.
So, well, one of the things about this film is that it's in six parts, and then there's an epilogue as well. And the film is quite long. I think it's 2.5 hours.
150, yeah.
So it's a lengthy film, and it's not a quick 2.5 hours either. You kind of have to stick it out. And I think, you know, that's one of my problems with it. I think the pace kind of dips and drags a little bit in places. But it's, for me, less about kind of plot and pacing and more about mood. And it creates this really charged, erotic mood. There's not really any kind of like sex or romance in it. It's just all kind of like undertones, and the dance sequences are also very sexy.
I think there's a lot of sex in it, but yeah. it's through the medium of dance, which is sort of safer sex in some kind of way. But I do think it's a very sexy movie, and as you say, I don't think it is about plot and pacing, which is why it's a little bit long. If you haven't really got, you know, much to say past the 2 hour mark, then it would have perhaps been better condensed, but then we'd have lost the kind of the guignol, the colours. You know, once you're in it, I'm not leaving this dinner. I'm staying right to the end.
It's a beautiful thing. I mean, it looked like a lot of... Guadagnino works a lot for fashion houses and shoots amazing sort of opulent short films and does a lot of work, set design and all the rest of it. And you could see that in it. There are some wonderful... Tilda Swinton, in fact, a lot of the actresses in it are great. They're very good actresses, but they're very good clothes horses as well, right? And there's some great, beautiful shots in it that look like they could have been ripped from an advert page from Vogue. They look like a kind of Gucci
car ad. Commercial or something.
Stunning.
There, exactly.
I mean it's really stunning.
When they're all wearing the red and the dance troupe are all wearing that red ribbon stuff. I mean, that you literally expect an Alfa Romeo to kind of charge past.
Yeah, exactly.
And waving in the wind.
And the interiors as well, right? There's some absolutely stunning. There's a lot of big high doors and windows that open up and all
Sorts
the rest of it.
Beige and burgundy and brown, and a friend of mine, she kind of saw the reference that I have to credit her and not steal it for myself, but she saw the references Prada's autumn 2014 collection, the trench coats and the kind of beige long skirts. It's worth giving that a Google.
Right, so you think he's basing it actually on that runway?
I don't know if it's like a direct reference point, but I think there's a sort of Prada palette going
good
on.
Good spot. Now, and also, let's not forget I Am Love, which was shot in Milan and in that house, that industrial house with the best cutlery ever. I mean, he's very
beautiful.
Wedded to buildings as locus. So even the villa in Bigger Splash and the palazzo in Call Me By Your Name, these buildings have a character. And this building is, in fact, the central character. It kind of moves and shakes and informs what's going on psychologically in the character. So I think he's very kind of architectural in that sort of interior, how they work on our interiors. And I think this film throbs with history. I heard someone sort of saying, well, it's rather too obvious. It's about fascism and the kind of, you know, the Nazism. But you were talking about 70s Berlin.
Yeah.
You can't get away from that legacy. This is the place where it happened. The ghosts are sort of live in the streets.
And that's very front and centre. The way that the old film, it was sort of understood that would be in the periphery because it was a film made in 1977. This is a film set in 1977. So all of that Baader-Meinhof, that Red Army faction and the Second World War and all the rest of it, and especially Klemperer's character draws you right back to all that stuff.
It certainly does. And I think the dance is about that stuff. The dance is interpreting history.
It's like the final dance is called Volk, which is obviously a very troublesome...
It's a troublesome title and it's a troublesome piece as well. Yeah, I mean, it's very powerful. It reminds me of sort of Pina Bausch and even Hoffa Schechter, what he does now. So I think those were rather beautifully done. They're not easy to do. And I think Tilda Swinton's having a ball in the middle of that, bossing people about. It's a hot thing we do, she says, ballet. And I thought I think she improvised that line. She must have put that in. It just sounds like Tilda Swinton. It reeks of Tilda Swinton. But I think she's magnificent in it, imperious, and that's how you want your Tilda Swinton to be. I wouldn't mess with her.
Yeah, no, she's a very attractive character, terrifying.
There's also a great scene of her eating fried chicken with Dakota Johnson, which is all I've ever wanted to see on film, to be honest.
There's a lot of fried chicken about. There's a Green Book I saw recently that's got a fried chicken scene in it as well. It's very important. It's always an important kind of prop of our day. But the other thing we must say about Tilda Swinton, I don't know if we're allowed to say it or not.
The multiple characters.
Yes.
The multiple.
She doesn't play just Madame Blanc.
No, I think we can say. I think that's kind of part and parcel of it. Part of the mystery is she also... Well, you can tell us.
Well, yes, because when I was watching, I was thinking, that bloke looks a bit weird, that Mr. Klemperer.
Yeah.
A bit odd. And then there was some... It's a very funny history of it, because Dakota Johnson was asked this in an interview before the film was out, when it was at festivals, Venice and then Toronto. And she went, no, what do you mean? No, it's lovely. Mr. Klemperer was a great actress played by Elsa Eberhafter. And she was really great, really good. And then Luca Guadagnino started denying. And then eventually Tilda Swinton admitted it, said, it was me in prosthetics.
Yeah.
So now it's out there. It was her.
Yeah.
It's not her, it's her. She's playing an actress who plays this guy. So she's invented a character for herself to play this guy.
There is another actress that she is playing that has had the prostheses.
Exactly.
Attached.
So it isn't Tilda technically her. Apparently, and then Luca told me at the London Film Festival that actually I'm going to see it again because she plays a third character somewhere in the movie as well. And I haven't spotted
that. So I've read
yet.
And I couldn't spot that. I couldn't spot that when I saw
it. Do you want me to spoil it?
Yeah, maybe we can't
so
say
you
that.
Know, you spotted it.
So I went into the film not realising that she had played multiple roles and read about them afterwards. And when you think about it in hindsight, it's actually quite obvious. And I think the prosthetic makeup is quite bad.
It's terrible. Yeah.
What's good?
Yeah, I don't really understand what the point is.
What I was going to ask, Simran, is because there are moments, quite a lot of the emotional punch of the film is delivered through the character of Klemperer, actually. And it's strange that you can't act so well with prostheses. And a lot, it's face work, right? This is close-up face work. So it's a little bit of a funny one. You kind of want your two main protagonists to be doing that. Do you know what I mean?
For me, I don't really understand that character. I don't really understand his function other than maybe as a way into the school, although we do have Dakota Johnson and Susie for that. And I think the interesting thing about Klemperer is that he is the only male character in the whole film.
Yeah.
Everybody else is a woman, and it's this very kind of matriarchal, sort of women-heavy coven. And so it's interesting that there is just this one male character, and he has a really sort of a line that really annoyed me when some character, I can't remember exactly who it is, tells him off, and she says to him, you know, you don't listen to women, they tell you the truth, and you... I wrote it down, actually. When women tell you the truth, you don't pity them, you tell them that they have delusions. And I just felt like that was so on the nose, you know. I get that this film is being made in a sort of feminist moment and that it wants to telegraph its sort of women front politics, but I just thought that was too obvious.
Does it do that? Because people in Venice were very women, women critics, women film journalists, they were sort of upset by this. They sort of said, oh God, you know, does it have to be every time women get together, it's a coven? And Luca found himself sort of being attacked for what was not a very sensitive portrayal of where we are now and where the feminist movement is. And then he was a bit upset by this because he was like, well, I'm the last person, you know, I'm all sensitive and I'm Italian. And I'm like, well, that doesn't really give you carte blanche or whatever that is in Italian.
It's a funny one because those original gialli, those original Italian horror films of that era of, you know, the 70s were very sexploitation. They were horror sexploitation. So this is kind of, I think, the hope, maybe, if there was any positive desire to do anything, was maybe to turn that on its head slightly. I kind of got the feeling.
I mean, I kind of saw it as trying to imagine itself as a sort of feminist text. You know, you've got all these women, their power is being suppressed or is being hidden. It's a matriarchal kind of lineage. It's all about what women's bodies can do and the sort of power of the female body. And of course, they're witches in hiding. I think it's interesting read in that way. And I like that it's doing that. I just felt like some of the dialogue was a little bit expositional.
There is a bit of that. I wanted to ask you whether, I said this in the introduction, whether something can both be cold-blooded and camp. There's an austerity to the character of Tilda Swinton, but then at the same time, it is such a ludicrous, and there is one scene which we won't spoil where it all kind of really goes bananas.
Oh, it gets more. I mean, what, it's about an hour where it goes bananas.
Yeah. There's quite a big one. But can we be? Is it both cold-blooded and camp? Is that sort of fair enough?
It's definitely camp.
Yeah.
It isn't funny camp.
No.
Which I think we think giallos are, although I think in the 70s I don't know if we like them. They're lurid and they're kind of bright, but I don't know if they're camp. Camp to me suggests there's some knowing irony involved, and I don't think there is irony. I think Lucas can be very serious about his work, you know, and about his things and about his cutlery and about his design. You know, he doesn't have a great laugh. Bigger Splash was probably the one that had the most irony in it, directed and kind of via the figure of Ralph Fiennes. So this one doesn't really have any moments of humour in it. It has over-the-topness and kind of grand guignol, but camp, yes, it is camp, but not as we know it.
I think maybe I wouldn't use the word camp. I think maybe that word is a bit loaded. But what I do think this film is, it's goofy. It's really goofy. Like, I think the prosthetics, the dynamic between Tilda Swinton and the students, the weird sexual tension between Tilda Swinton and Dakota Johnson, I think the mad set piece at the end, which I think doesn't quite work for me. That's when the film sort of lost me and it had cultivated this sort of slow simmering.
It went a bit sort of League of Gentlemen.
Exactly. But I do think it's kind of goofy in a way that interested me.
Yeah, it's because that the prosthetics on, they reminded me of the prosthetics at the end of the Rupert Everett thing, Another Country, where they played the spies and they kind of cut forward to when after the Cold War, and there they are in Russia, and they look like Rupert Everett in that prosthetic makeup. Maybe it was a little ode to him.
Yeah. Maybe, exactly. He'd be flattered by that.
He'd love to have been in this.
Yeah, he would have loved to have been in it. What about the gore? Because the gore is as gory as kind of classic 70s Italian horror movie, but it's sitting in the context of a very lush, beautiful, as we said, something that not nods its head to Gucci and Prada and fashion advertising in lots of ways, and great beauty. How does the gore sit with you? Because there's one very gory scene, this big set piece near the end, which we talked about, and there are some dream sequences that it turns out that Tilda Swinton enforces on Dakota Johnson's character. She's having these awful dreams, and they're very spooky and strange.
Yeah,
aren't
they are.
But then all the gore comes in one sort of, in one place.
Yeah, I don't know what horror purists would say about the role of gore and where the shocks and jump scares and where they play their role, because I think he's trying to frustrate these and to do it all at once. And I quite liked it. The Italians invented the Benetton adverts, which had all the sort of babies. They invented gore with beauty in order to sell fashion. So it didn't sit awkwardly with me. I was waiting for it, and I found that the bone cracking scenes, you know, when the dancer becomes, you know,
that's a kind of amazing scene.
Mirror, I thought that was absolutely amazing. Yeah. I was hooked from there because I thought the power of dance, the power of the female body, as Simran says, and the power of the ghosts that were kind of operating here, that was coming up through this building, that hooked me, and that had me sort of glued to my seat, like I was in that building myself. I couldn't escape the history and the power of these images in front of me.
That's sort of the most ingenious scene, isn't it? That's the one that sticks in my memory, that one.
I mean, I find that scene quite gory and actually very graphic. So if anyone hasn't seen the film, you shouldn't be listening to this. No, there's a scene where Dakota Johnson is doing a dance sequence in one room, and then in another room, the camera is sort of cutting between these two sequences, and every movement that she does articulates the body of another dancer, but in quite horrible ways that are very unnatural and sort of make her bones snap.
It's kind of like an accidental. On one side it's a dance scene, on the other side it's a fight scene.
Yeah,
exactly. But it's sort of with an invisible assailant, and it's really horrifying and kind of visceral and sickening.
Like a voodoo doll being worked as well. But it is. I mean, you'll need to go to an osteopath after that. You're like,
And the noises as well. They're so kind of. Oh, it actually makes me feel quite ill thinking about it.
So I think he's got this synesthetic gift, Luca, for design, and it all comes together. And I think he's kind of off the hook in Suspiria with it. Though Suspiria does mean a sigh, isn't it? Suspiria in Latin, and probably in Italian too. So there is a point where this film just sort of becomes a sort of long sigh.
Long exhalation.
And I suppose that's what ballet is in some way as well. You know, you have to breathe all the way through the move.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating film. I think 150 minutes is indulgent, though, too much. But, you know, sometimes when you're Luca Guadagnino, if he can't indulge, who else
who can? Indulge, exactly? Who in this business can? Let's talk a little bit about his oeuvre then, because Simran prefaced her comments by giving us a little bit of rundown of what she thought about each one of his films. And I think I like it. I think it's a strength that you can make a kind of very stylish but schlocky gore, you know, giallo movie. You can make a gay romance, etc. I think that's a strength. I mean, I'm always intrigued to see what he's going to do next. What do we think? Do people think he should just forever do spot paintings?
I don't know if I see this Suspiria as a kind of giallo film. I think there is violence and there is gore, but those are sort of small bursts that sort of happen throughout the film, but actually in the context of the film it is quite muted, perhaps more so than his other films, which are, you know, more emotional perhaps. But I think he's an interesting filmmaker. I think he is very good at design and sort of set and architecture and making, as we said before, making the settings the star of the film. I think maybe there is something about him that doesn't quite click with me, and I'm not sure what it is. Maybe it is this indulgence, and he loves that, doesn't he? He's all about kind of indulging in these highfalutin emotions and yeah, these very kind of like sweet relationships. Yeah. So maybe that's why this film is interesting to me more so than some of the others.
I think there's violence in the relationships though as well. Yeah. Some of them are sweet, but some of them are...
Ralph Fiennes and Tilda Swinton is the rock star. And the manager.
It's almost rendered her mute. Yeah. You know, she doesn't want to see this guy. And in I Am Love, there's the family are, you know, they kind of expel Tilda in some way, and so the love is illicit, and they're very baroque. I mean, I Am Love is entirely baroque. It's been running around the rooftops, and
it's really baroque, but it's set in Milan, and it's super stylish and Milanese rather than Roman. It's very kind of northern Italian,
it's industrial,
aristocratic industry thing. It's an interesting, it's a really interesting thing.
And I think he has a more of a Milanese sensibility than any kind of southern sensibility.
Yeah.
You know, even though when they went to Pantelleria, it wasn't he's not a southern neorealist filmmaker. Yeah. It's Boho's from Milan going on holiday. It's very much this kind of visiting.
Yeah.
I'm a patrician from the industrial north with my style. That's where Prada comes into it. He is, I think, I don't know if he is Milanese, but that it's that sensibility rather than any Roman Fellini-esque one or that we get with Paolo Sorrentino, very much kind of slightly more from the south.
Some Neapolitan. Kind of,
yeah, Neapolitan.
Thing. This is almost like a Neapolitan film, like a splashy sort of, it could be a splashy, trashy, lurid thing made by a Milanese, sort of a buttoned up Milanese.
It's what they feel. It's kind of what it is down there. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is our sort of, this is our extra reading section where we ask you guys what this kind of, what this reminded you of and where it took you. Simran, you wanted to talk about Dakota Johnson in the kind of notorious 50 Shades movies.
Yes, I do. Because when I watched this film, I thought, oh my God, she's doing the same thing that she's doing in the first 50 Shades of Grey film. And, you know, I'm only really here for the first one. I've seen all three. The second one is awful. The third one is possibly worse.
What are they called?
50 Shades Darker is the second one, and 50 Shades Freed is
Freed
is the third one. Except I don't know if that's an accurate title, seeing as the whole plot is that they get married. spoilers.
Now you've ruined it.
Oh, God. But I think the first film is interesting and sort of sly, and it's a sort of critique of capitalism. I don't think it really works as the erotic thriller that people expected these movies to be, based on the books, which, of course, as we all know, were not very erotic at all.
But you read them?
No, thankfully I've been spared. But I did read that they were sort of came out of fan fiction about Twilight. Apparently she E.L. James had read Stephanie Meyer's Twilight books and tried to make a sort of BDSM themed version of them, which I think squares if you think about the plot of these films. But anyway, I think the movie itself is sort of, it's fine, but Dakota Johnson, her performance is incredible in it. She's inscrutable. You can't read her, and I think she sort of uses that unreadability as a tool. And I think there's a dissonance between the Jamie Dornan character of Christian Grey, who's sort of very flat, very robotic, sort of playing it straight but just not playing it well.
It's and Jamie Dornan for you.
You know, it's a very wooden performance. Yeah. And I think Dakota, I think she's very deadpan. I think she, if you watch it again, there's just something that she's doing where she's having a bit more fun with it, even though she's got this blankness in her face. I think she's sort of, you know, playing with it. And I think that's going on here.
There's certainly that in this, isn't there?
There's an innocence and a playfulness that's going on in Suspiria where she's sort of understands the material and is very playful with it. So,
and she is just a sort of normal, because she's a normal girl from, she's from the countryside,
from Ohio. But she's had a very religious upbringing, so that kind of comes
Sort of. Well, and there's the bit where that we talked about earlier with the red tape thing that the dancers have. This kind of, and that there's a bit in, I think it's the second 50 Shades. I only know this from clips, but she's in a DIY store and they use kind of, you know,
gets bound
cable
up.
Ties to kind of tie each other up. Have I just dreamt that?
I don't remember the precise details of what was used to tie her up in those films. But,
I think... You don't go to B&Q much, do you, Simran? I can see that.
No, I'm not much of a DIY type myself.
That could have gone either of two ways. We went to B&Q. Damn. Okay.
I think she is a really interesting performer, and I've been watching her for a while. I thought she was brilliant in... her sort of very small scene in The Social Network. That was her sort of first thing that people saw her in, and she has a 3-minute scene with Justin Timberlake. But if you watch the film again, she's actually very witty in that very small role. She is pretty good in the romantic comedy How to Be Single, which is kind of okay, actually, but she's sort of interesting in that film. And she's in A Bigger Splash as well, so she's worked with Guadagnino before. although she looks quite different in that film. Okay. It seems like a while ago. She seems to have grown up a lot since. Yeah. And yeah, so I've been watching her with interest. And yeah, I thought she was just fascinating to watch. She had a physicality in this that really was just so compelling. And I think the 50 Shades of Grey films, people really criticise those for being sexless. And having these explicit scenes where there was really no erotic charge, and people maybe wondered whether that was a problem to do with Dakota Johnson or just how the films were made. And clearly it's not a problem
sexy
to do with
film,
her performance.
The films that are meant to be sexy aren't, and something like this was very sexy. I agree with you, Jason. Do you know what I mean?
It's all in the breathing, you know. She does a lot of heavy breathing. There's also another scene in, I think it's one of the dance sequences, where she's sort of on all fours and she looks like she's an animal about to pounce on her prey. And she's very cat-like in this. I love watching her. I could watch her all day.
It's a supremely physical performance. Which yeah, she's a good
dancer.
She does the dance very well. I didn't
know
apparently
she trained for like a year and a half or something.
Talking of which, we can ask Jason about Pina Bausch, which was Wim Wenders' documentary.
It
about
reminded
Pina Bausch.
Me of that. Obviously, Wim Wenders is German and lives in Berlin, and Pina Bausch did as well. And he made a documentary about her called Pina, simply Pina. Unless it was the Spanish piña, which would have been pineapple, but it isn't. It's pina. And little accents can get you a long way.
They can.
The linguists, aren't you, Jason?
So the Pina Bausch was, and it was amazing. It's one of the best 3D films. It's a documentary, but it puts Pina Bausch's company in the light, and it takes them out and about in various German locations to do their dancing. And Pina invented this very physical kind of hurt dance that people smashed against the floor, used the body, took ballet in a new direction. I mean, she's the kind of founding mother of contemporary dance that Hoffa Schechter owes a lot to, and all of those kind of other contemporary ones that are around now, and the one that did the moves that you see in a Bader-Meinhof connection here in Tebbi that recently Jose Padilla did. There was a dance sort of troupe in that kind of expressing the action, and that was sort of set, that's a sort of 70s set in Tebbi thing. So this is all from the same. So it really reminded me of all of those. And I think Wim Wenders' documentary is probably one of the best dance movies ever made, and it's certainly one of the best 3D uses of 3D because you circle the dancers and actually they come alive in the 3D. I was thinking the other day, gosh, 3Ds feel so passé, you know. It was such a waste of time. Very rarely does it enhance the movie, but it did enhance Wim's documentary there.
Strangely, it's a thing that's enhanced documentaries. The Werner Herzog one about the caves,
which was
wonderful. Again, that was much better in documentary than in feature films, in fiction.
Yeah,
films,
because it's not a narrative. It's not a narrative, so you don't need it in fiction. Yeah. But I think it adds a layer of reality in documentaries, or irreality in documentaries, which kind of adds to their fact that they're supposed to be, you know, purporting to reflect reality. But anyway, Pina Bausch, you don't get to see her much unless you're a big sort of dance fan, and that was seeing her legacy there, and it's definitely the influence on this sort of dance in,
yeah,
in,
for sure, in, and it's that part. It's that sort of the matriarch, the kind of austere matriarch, who, you know, is always the last to walk into the room, is always the last major character to appear in this film, and all the rest of it. It seems very Pina Bausch.
It's always those. And a little bit Debbie Allen from The Kids from Fame as well. Yeah. Right, here's where you start paying the sweat.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I'm glad we brought Fame into it. We managed to get through the whole thing without even thinking of a leg warmer. It's not that kind of film.
Could have done with some leg warmers, because those bones, you know, dancers and bones are really... Oh,
it would have been a good tourniquet for some of the blood, an extra tight leg warmer.
Very stylish leg warmer.
Exactly. Well, I think all three of us are kind of saying go and see Suspiria. I certainly really enjoyed it.
I think it's a real big screen indulgence.
Take a sandwich.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's showing on Mubi.
Take a fried chicken sandwich.
Yeah. But I think it's a real big screen to, like, you want to hear it, you want to... kind of something to dive into, I don't think you dive into it. I think it kind of dives into you. It comes at you. You kind of can't avoid it.
It certainly does. It brings us to the end of today's show. Suspiria is out in cinemas now. Thanks to my guests, Jason Solomons and Simran Hans, and to my producer, of course, Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week when we'll be discussing festive advertising. But until then, for me, Robert Bound, thanks for tuning in.